Okay, first of all, thank you very much for the space and the invitation to be here. I want to tell you about the molecular revolution. And the molecular revolution, which is ongoing, and how our path can be modified by this revolution. So to put this in context, from where we start with this molecular revolution, one can use, or frequently we use analogies in science to talk about reality. So for biochemists, life is a kind of molecular theater. So we know, thanks to geologists, that the Earth was formed approximately 4,500 million years. So since then, thanks to geochemical processes and biological processes later on, molecules have been transforming continuously. So shortly after this hot rock was cooling, living beings started forming. So a long time ago, many years ago, biomolecules came up, among them nucleic acids, which have been mentioned a lot in the presentations before, lipids, carbohydrates that we associate to food and in particular to junk food, and proteins. So sometime later, after these molecules were formed, they started associating and forming the first cells. We've had many talks in which they have defined or described how cells are, why they're important. Here we have examples of three different cells. And, well, an important thing to clarify or to point out is that this molecular theater is relatively young, relatively recent. It's maybe 4,000 million years, sounds like a long time, but in geological times it's not that much. So the most interesting part is that in these 4,000 million years, thanks to molecular evolution, we've generated organisms that are adapted to pretty much every environment that we can find in the Earth. So you can think that a hydrothermal vent at 100 degrees in the bottom of the ocean, which releases lots of acid, is a place which is not suitable for life, but we know that probably it was exactly there where life was originated, and from there it started spreading everywhere. So now it doesn't really matter where we look in the North Pole, in the oceans, inside the Earth, and on the Earth crust. Everywhere there seems to be organisms. Above all, microorganisms, but also macroscopic organisms. So the most interesting part is that in this molecular theater, the main actresses are proteins. Why? Because basically all living beings of this planet use proteins in order to conduce chemical reactions, to feed ourselves, to grow, and to reproduce. This is, in molecular terms, living. So proteins are important basically because they convert genetic information into physical and chemical capabilities. So when we were told, okay, this gene causes a disease, or it's used for this or that, in the end it's not the gene what does the action. The gene only has the information to construct a protein. And it's a protein, the molecular machine, that does things. So then, proteins are the workers, the molecular workers in the cell. They're in charge of defining what we can do in chemical terms and what we can't do. So it doesn't matter if we think of different animals or any kind of organism, what we can do is due to the proteins that we have. I don't want to be an extremist to think that everything is codified in genes and in proteins. For example, rhinoceros, they get their horns because of their genetic information, but in humans, we get horny because of other reasons. So in the end, the image in the center, there's a bunch of chemical reactions. So the idea is that proteins, what they do, they break and they create bondage between molecules, and molecules are basically what we're made of. in biology or in biochemistry, there is a dogma that has been broken many times, which says that one goes from genes to proteins, and that therefore there is a relation between the nucleotide sequence in DNA, between the letters in the genetic code, with the molecules that we can produce. This is a different vision from a cell that was shown before. This is an Escherichia coli, an E. coli cell, which is enlarged 100,000 times approximately, and this is not an image from microscopy. This is an image between science and art, constructed in first place using the information of the structure of proteins, but also with the coloring from an artist. So let's zoom into this bacteria, which is E. coli, which is the most used bacteria in biology and in biochemistry to do genetic studies and protein engineering. And this bacteria is very common. It's mainly in shit. That's why we call it coli. And maybe because it's there, we use it for a lot of things. So if we zoom in to the cell, into the cell, we see that it has a membrane. This hairs that you see outside, it's polysaccharides, and we have this this band formed by lipids, and then inside we see a lot of little balls with different shapes and sizes. So all these little balls are proteins, and in the most classical cell visions, we're shown that they have organelles, and it would seem that the cell is like a kind of soup that has a nucleus somewhere and a mitochondria somewhere there. But more than a soup, it's like a very thick soup, which is full of proteins. If we start studying proteins and see their shape, their structure, we see that they have very different shapes. And these shapes allow proteins to carry out their functions. In principle, after this, we should see a video, but we cannot see it, in which there is a detailed explanation which is the chemical way in which proteins are formed. In the end, proteins are chains of amino acids. They're large molecules. These are macromolecules that are formed by smaller molecules, which are amino acids. And depending on the amino acids in each protein, it takes its structure. And this structure is important because depending on the shape of the molecule is the kind of activity that it can perform. So we have some... So proteins, we were saying, they're everywhere, and they have many different sizes. There are some very small ones, and we call them peptides. And when they have more than 50 or 100 amino acids, then we call them proteins. So among peptides, which are small, but they're very important, is insulin, which is there. But we have a lot of different proteins, and they carry out different functions. They have a specific function in the cell. So we have proteins that work as a cover, as a shield. There's a virus here, this ball here. And as you can see, well, it's relatively small compared to the molecules here. So if an average bacteria has millions of molecules, you can imagine that a virus which is very small, which is as small as this, there's only a few molecules. So proteins are important because, for example, they help us differentiate what is ours from what isn't. That is, when our organism faces a foreign molecule, like a bacteria, or like a pathogenic bacteria, it's recognized thanks to a protein or a kind of proteins, which are antibodies, which are the ones here above the virus. Proteins also help us digest food. So we have proteins that degrade other proteins, and this helps us digest meat and the proteins in vegetables, but we also have proteins that break carbohydrates and lipids. So thanks to proteins, we can perform a lot of chemical reactions which are necessary to keep us alive. Apart from this, it's also important. It's also an important part of our structures. So muscles, they're also formed of proteins. General, when you say protein, what do you think? It's a piece of meat, but in the grains of corn, there's protein. In leaves, there's protein. There's practically protein. There's almost in everything, there's protein. DNA itself, in order to be translated into useful information, it needs the action of proteins. Here we have a DNA chain, which is being recognized by different protein molecules. So that's the place of the video. I can later give you the web address so you can see it. So one of the important things here is that in order for a protein to function, this function needs to be given by the shape. And the most interesting of it all is that, as we were saying at the beginning, all living beings in this planet use proteins. So here we have the comparison between a protein that has the same function in a bacteria, in spinach, and in ourselves. And as you can see, the structure of the three of them is very, very similar. So this that we were seeing 2 or 3 days ago, that we share 50% of our DNA with bananas, in the end it has to do with the fact that molecules that are necessary for the banana plant to live are also proteins. So microscopic functions and molecular functions that they need to carry out are the same. So in this way, we're related to the rest of living beings of this planet. So it doesn't matter at which level of the biological scale we think, we all have similar proteins. And the closer organisms are, the more similar their proteins will be. So what makes organisms different is the presence of new proteins that might have new functions. So why should we study proteins? Well, we must say that to start with, all diseases are related to proteins, be it because there is a mutation or a genetic defect and we have a protein that doesn't work properly and that causes a disease, or because we had the disadvantage or we were unlucky to find a bacteria and then their protein starts damaging us. In all these cases, there's always a protein at the origin. Proteins are also important in biotechnology because they create cleaner ways to transform molecules. We were saying a short while ago that proteins are part of a molecular revolution. In human terms, there have been several molecular revolutions. One of them, a very large one, was done by chemists during the 19th and 20th centuries. And thanks to them, we have polymers and other things. And also, thanks to this, we have the degree of pollution that we have in the planet. So the advantage of proteins as chemical transformers with respect to catalysts, to chemistry science done by chemists, is that the chemistry of living beings is a lot friendlier with the environment. To carry out the same chemical reactions, we can use a small test tube with bacteria that are carrying out chemical reactions, or we can use a big reactor that needs a high pressure, a high temperature, and which also generates a lot of toxic refuse. It doesn't mean that biotechnology is completely safe. It also has its problems. So knowing proteins is also important from the point of view of philosophy and from a personal point of view, because it allows us to know ourselves and also to know our place with respect to the rest of nature. In the last 50 years, we've determined about 650 million DNA sequences, which are all deposited in databases. Well, not all of them, because there are, some of them are under enterprise control, but most of them are available in data banks of DNA. And the sequences that are known, they come from about 300,000 different organisms. So this 650 million sequences, and we only know the form of about 127,000 of them. So what the structures that we know with respect of the sequences that we know is very little. So even though we have the book of the instructions to make a human being, the human genome, we do not have the book to translate those sequences of DNA. So if we analyze this information, we see that in the last 50 years, we've been capable of knowing about 0.001% of the total estimate of sequences that are actually used by living beings in this planet. So basically the message is that we know a minute part of the existing proteins in nature. So we have a great area of opportunity in the future to know the rest before that the other part is extinguished. So we can calculate to not only the amount of proteins or of sequences that we use, that living beings use here on Earth now, but of all living beings that have lived in this planet. So in this great molecular theater of life, in the life of Earth, we have of the order of 10 to the 12 sequences of proteins. So that's a 1 followed by 12 zeros. That's a very large number. So what this is telling us is basically that from the beginning, in the first shapes of life, dinosaurs and us, all of us, we've used these molecules to live. So this number might seem large, and in general we use it to talk about how imposing and diverse nature is. The next molecular revolution comes from the fact that even though this number is very large, how large it is, it's relative. If we calculate how many possible sequences for a protein of 200 nucleotides we can make, this number is 20 to the power 200. So what happens with the numbers with powers is that it's very easy to get lost in their size. 20 to the 200th power, it in practical terms, this number is infinite. The number of atoms in the universe is less than this number, which means that if we would use all the atoms in the universe to build proteins, we would not have enough atoms in the universe to construct all the possible proteins. What this means is that life in this planet has explored a very, very, very little part of the possible number of sequences. The question is, how much can we explore in this space? So there is the analogy here of the sky. How much can we move into the future? Well, that's where the next molecular revolution is. This is not the first one or the only one. And the idea is the following. Living beings have been evolving thanks to the selection pressures. And what we've been doing is, thanks to mutations in our DNA, like making these yellow dots here grow little by little. The idea is that such as a cell always comes from a previous cell, a DNA always comes from a previous DNA. So the DNA that we can create and that we normally see is related to other molecules that have been there before. So living beings, what we do is explore or make grow these yellow zones in this map. The idea is that with the help of computers and physical chemistry, we can adventure ourselves to those regions in blue. So it's going out of these points to go and explore what we know as the space of sequences. So this has been an idea in the scientific community for a long time. But until recently, it was not possible to design really new proteins. It's possible through mutagenesis to change a bit the sequence of amino acids and make proteins change their function a little bit. But the question is how much we can change them or create new proteins. That can now be done. Up to date, we have well done in one lab in the world, and in that lab they have created proteins that do not exist in nature. So all these structures that we see here are different from the structures that we see in living beings. They're made of the same blocks, of the same forms, which are those cylinders that we see there, but arranged in a different way. So that's how we mean by protein design. So in this principle, protein design, this can be used to make new nanomaterials. They were also talking about nanobiology yesterday, and in principle, but this is still further ahead, in principle we should be able to design new enzymes and to design inhibitors for proteins that we know. So, throughout the history of this planet, proteins have been used by all living beings to adapt to the changes in their environment. We can ask ourselves now, what would we like to design proteins, and what will they be useful for? So, if you see the website of any biochemical department in any university in the world, this is to solve the problems of food, health, and energy of humanity. So proteins are going to save the world. So here is perhaps where it's clearer, the social or capitalist use that you can give to science, what things have been done. So as the first example, we have HIV. Shortly after, which was the cause of AIDS, labs of industrialized countries went on to study the proteins that formed this virus. So we know perfectly the structure of each of the molecules that compose HIV. So in a relatively short time, it was possible to create molecules that interact with the proteins and inhibit them. So all medical treatments in the fight against AIDS are molecules that go and attach themselves to the proteins of the HIV virus. So in principle, those molecules do not only attach to the HIV molecules, but they also attach to our proteins. So those are the secondary effects that the medicines have. The idea is that the more we know about the structure of these molecules, it's easier to design molecules and medicines that are capable of attaching only to the molecules of the virus and not to our molecules. So the point now here is what we study, because it's clear that mostly at the beginning, when AIDS was a disease in developed countries, it was very interesting for pharmaceutical companies to study the proteins of this organism, but later on, when it started to be controlled in developed countries and it stopped, it started expanding in Africa and other regions, then the interest was lost. Same happens with a lot of different molecules. So there are molecules that help to lose weight, to modulate pressure, but there are very few new molecules that are being used to attack diseases in the third world. So simply in the final minutes, I would like to bring up the point of how we do science and why. So the first point is that scientific research itself, it's clearly human activity. So therefore, its products and its exercise, knowledge and everything is also human activity. We can also acquire scientific knowledge from many sources. However, scientific research is a kind of craft in the sense that we learn to do science by doing science, not in books and not through the internet. We can learn scientific knowledge and learn information from a book, but doing science, we need to learn by doing with other people. Labs are the place where we do experimental science, and these labs are above all human groups, and as such, they're subject to all the vices and virtues that we generate in our interaction. Labs have personality, and this is dynamic. And it's dynamic because the members of labs are modified in time, although they're always the lead researchers, but students come, they learn, they go and work in another lab. So the personality depends a lot on the people, it's determined by the people who are there, by researchers and students. So there are labs, there are small labs, large labs, formal labs, informal ones, slavery labs. There are labs where people are not allowed to listen to music or talk of things that are not related to science, but there are also labs which are a lot more modern and open. Independently of its size, due to a historic question, labs usually have a vertical pyramid structure. The direction is usually relying in one person. So science is a group activity, and in experimental science, the lab is your closest group. This is the first battlefield in the construction of a different science. That is, I think it's not possible to do committed science, left-wing science, or popular or activist in a lab which has a business-like structure. This is like the syndrome of the machista revolutionary. In the same way that you cannot say that you are in favor of revolution and change, and then after talking to people, go home and ask the wife or order the wife to serve food, there's a big contradiction in it. So we also cannot do committed science in a lab where the boss obliges students to do experiments and forces them and tells them what can be done and what cannot be done. In our case, I belong to the physical chemistry and protein engineering lab. But it's a big name, but well, that's how it is. And there, instead of being a single person lab, we have five researchers to try and make a common space in which we share instruments and resources. And the most important is that it's a place where students, people who go do their graduate thesis, they have an atmosphere in which they can interact with many researchers at the same time in a more horizontal way. I will not talk about scientific institutions that have all the vices that you can think of. I'd like to talk about scientific organizations. I am a biochemist, so to the conferences that I normally go is the conference of the Mexican Society of Biochemistry, which is a solid scientific society. I think that after science, after physics and chemistry, is one of the oldest in the country. It's 40 or 50 years old. And in this branch of, within the Society of Biochemistry, there is a branch of physical chemistry, structure and design of proteins, which is an association that has the objective to promote the usage and education of about proteins. We also have a network that has to do with this. And to finish, because I've been told that I have to finish now, I have to ask, okay, where are we going? Where are we headed to? So if you ask me, I think that we need to go to the lab. We were told a lot about committed science and activist science like agroecology. Well, structural biology is not in its origin an activist science. It comes from the other side. It comes from the big machines, the big capital. But this does not mean that it cannot be used to do science in a different way. And that's what I'd like to pose here. It seems that we all want to appropriate and participate in the rebel part of Pozol. I don't know if it's a fungus, but maybe the fungus produces a protein that is in charge of turning on the genes of rebels. And thanks for asking uncomfortable questions and asking what. And yeah, asking about the usage of science is an uncomfortable question, but it's very necessary. Thank you.